Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 32. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Is there such a thing as mental psychosis or neurosis? What impact do entheogens have on human maturation? What are the 10 lessons of psychedelic psychotherapy? What impact can psychedelics have on clinical practice? What is it like when doctors ask to become the patient at Burning Man? Today's guest is Dr. Neil Goldsmith. This is a very fascinating interview. Neil presents some very interesting information and looks at things regarding human problems with their current state of, well, maturation. So it brings an interesting new perspective on the way we look at mental problems and things like that. So I'm very happy to have Neil on the show. Neil Goldsmith, PhD, is a psychotherapist specializing in psycho-spiritual development and resistance to change, seeing neurosis as a natural unfolding of human maturation. He views psychology as the science of personal emergence and spiritual maturity. With the exception of biologically based diseases such as schizophrenia, psychology is not about mental illness. And so Dr. Goldsmith treats neurosis as spiritual immaturity and not pathology. In fact, he believes the quote-unquote sick label itself tightens and distorts, actually slowing healthy realignment. Dr. Goldsmith applies innovative techniques drawn from many schools of thought and traditional practices such as psychosynthesis, imago relationship therapy, regressive psychotherapies, Rogerian client-centered counseling, yoga psychology, and other humanistic transpersonal and Eastern traditions. He facilitates deep life review, awakening to personal history, and life planning. With a special focus on existential and midlife crisis with young adults suffering from lack of direction or substance abuse, Dr. Goldsmith is particularly helpful with couples, many feeling in love again after years of vicious cycles. Dr. Goldsmith has a master's degree in counseling from New York University and a PhD in psychology from Claremont Graduate University with an orientation toward action science in the tradition of Kurt Lewin. Dr. Goldsmith conducted his research dissertation on the factors that facilitate or inhibit the successful utilization of mental health policy research as a federally funded doctoral research assistant at Princeton University. He was also deputy principal investigator of this four-year nationwide study of mental health policy research utilization. Author of dozens of popular scholarly articles, Dr. Goldsmith is a frequent speaker on spiritual emergence, resistance to change, transpersonal psychology, drug policy reform, and the postmodern future of society. He has worked to improve the innovation process and facilitate the management of change for companies such as American Express, AT&T, and Gartner. Visit www.neal.goldsmith.com. Upcoming shows: G. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island on the Federal Reserve, and also Professor Benny Shannon, which I've just learned is the proper pronunciation of his last name, from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Israel. And he is the author of the number one book on ayahuasca, which is called Antipodes of the Mind. And I interviewed Benny last night, and it is a phenomenal interview. I'm very excited to get that out. It was really good to speak with him, and I think you out there in the listening audience will agree that it's a fantastic show and won't want to miss that. And if you're listening to the show and you'd like to help with other language additions, such as French or Arabic translations, I would love to get those languages added to the DVD and the online versions of the Pharmacratic Inquisition video. I also still need help with the transcriptions of these shows, if you can help with that. So if you're interested in helping, and maybe you can't afford to donate to the show right now, which I can understand with the economy the way it is, then this is another fantastic way that you can help out with Gnostic Media and some of the projects here. We do have a few of those finished and a few people have volunteered, but I can still use a lot more help on that. So please, please volunteer. If you are tempted to do so, please don't hesitate. We can still use your help. And things have really slowed down lately, so I appreciate those who have continued to support the show through your donations. And so, once again, thanks to all of you, and all of your donations are greatly appreciated. If you think the work being done here is important, I ask that you please support the show. We can really use your support right now, and I know it sucks to listen to me request donations each week, but without your donations, I'd have to pull the plug on the show. There is just no way without those of you who support this program to continue it without you. So anyway, by donating each week or each month or whatever you can afford, you are helping to get this information out to the world at large. So if you consider this type of work important, as I do, then please go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. And you can click on the donations button at the top left of the page there. And also, to support the show, you can buy one of the books or DVDs from the website. My book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, Christianity's Pagan Roots. I have 48 copies left of the color, numbered, and signed edition, and that comes with a free Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. And in that book, Andrew Taji and I go through the origins of religion via three primary foundations, which are astrotheology and archaeoastronomy, or the worship of the sun and the stars and the moon, as well as entheogens and fertility cults. And this book was just released in a brand new second edition a couple of months ago, which is heavily updated with a lot of new primary sources added to the book and lots of good updates. So get it while you can. When the numbered and signed copies are gone, they are gone. And in my last book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, I analyze and break down all of the arguments against John Allegro's work and the sacred mushroom and the cross, and I reveal the origin of these false attacks against him, and I also prove through ancient primary texts and iconography and modern clinical research that the overall theme of John Allegro's work was actually correct against many of the, as I said, false claims against his work. And today we do have solid proof that mushrooms were used in Judeo-Christianity. And so definitely check that out. Also at the Gnostic Media website, if you haven't already looked at it, is the She Who Remembers audio archives. And I mentioned last week that we have come across several hundred more hours worth of material that is both audio and video. And so if anybody would like to help with a major project to get that stuff digitized and out on the internet, I would greatly appreciate your help with that as well. I've got too many projects and research things going on right now, and things get spread too thin, and then nothing ends up getting done. So anyway, we can really use your support, however you can provide it. Once again, go to www.gnosticmedia.com, or you can contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. And just a heads up, at the beginning and end of this interview, I believe that I say it's podcast number 31, but please be aware that because of my extended two-part interview with Alan Piper last week and the week before, that this is actually podcast number 32, because his was once again a two-part interview. And that's it. Enjoy the show. Neil, welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast number 31. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm fine, Jan. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome, and I really appreciate you being part of the show. And you've got some interesting stuff, and I think it's important for everybody to hear all of these different angles that so many different researchers put out there. And by, you know, doing this interview and these projects, it gives people the ability to really grasp so many of these different angles from all of these different researchers in one whole. So I appreciate you being a part of it, of that.
No, that's a nice way to put it. It's my pleasure to join that process.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who is Neil Goldsmith?
Sure. I'm a psychotherapist right now. My background, I have a PhD in psychology, which I've applied in a variety of different ways. I had occasion to, I was asked to go down to the local middle school on their career day and tell the kids what it was like to be a psychologist. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm my psychedelics, I did have a chance to talk about visionary plants in the tribal tradition when we talked about drug abuse, to put things in context for them. But I also really talked about my background because I'm sort of like a poster boy for what it means to be a psychologist, because I've not only done applied research out in the field, you know, like a sociologist with rigor, but I've also done teaching, writing. I'm working on a book right now, Psychology. I've done consulting. I've worked as a technology strategist for large corporations, for AT&T and American Express. I've taught, I've done, you know, a variety of different things. I won't give you my whole chronology, but, I became very interested in research and policy research and the way we can change society with data. Good replicable, unbiased information should be implemented, you know, into policy and practice. And so that was my doctoral focus. After working for the corporate world for a bit, I got back and I reopened my clinical practice, which I had closed down to go get my doctorate. And when I came back around that time, it was a very, very, very different practice. So I'm a psychotherapist now, having done all that those other things. I also have a salon discussion group called Poetry Science Talks, which is neither about poetry nor science, actually. You might call it the integral sweet spot between the spiritual and the intuitive and the incommensurate, as represented by the word poetry, and the deterministic or the precipitate the concrete scientific. And so we look at the integral. We try to do nothing less than heal Cartesian duality, and we do a pretty good job of it, I think. I go out to Burning Man and volunteer at the Sanctuary, which is the chill tent, really, for people who need to take a break or who've taken, you know, too many psychedelics. I've had the great honor to help as part of my practice, because I have an interest and some experience with psychedelics, to help people who've not so much in the throes of a bad or a difficult trip, but more so in the days and weeks afterward. I've been called several times to help people reintegrate, and that's been an incredible experience, very educational and very, like I say, a big honor to be able to be called for that. I curate and host the annual Horizon Psychedelic Conference in New York City with my partner, Kevin Balktik, and we've done it 2 years in a row, and we're working on our third year right now, and it's research-oriented, although it's a public conference. So it's very well attended by, you know, all the civilians, but it has we make sure we focus pretty good on bringing in the raw work from Johns Hopkins.
Hey, Neil, You're cutting out a little bit there. Is your laptop still out of range there? I mean, is it still in the other location? Because you're cutting out about once a minute.
Yes, you were too. So I am in the other location still. So if you like, I'll head on down. I was talking about, so I also curate and host the Horizon Psychedelics Conference in New York City down in Washington Square Park. And I've been doing that for 3 years now with my partner, Kevin Balkdick. And we, the conference is for the public, and it talks about, you know, we had Alex Gray there, for example, and other sort of more popular folks like Dan Pinchbeck. But a good, you know, two-thirds of the focus, a good half of the focus is on research, research and policy. So we've had Ethan Nadelman, and we've had Roland Griffiths from Johns Hopkins, who did the wonderful study on mysticism and psilocybin with normals, not a clinical population. Ethan is the founder of the Drug Policy Alliance. And so we've had a lot of very accessible public information about state-of-the-art research and policy issues. So we love Horizons, and I encourage you to go take a look, all the listeners, to horizonsnyc.com to learn more about that one. You know, so right now I'm doing psychotherapy. I'm writing something called Psychotherapy, Psychedelics, and Change. I've written, I had a chapter in the first, psychedelics textbook, medical school textbook in 40 years, the psychedelic medicine book, by you've got to fill me in here. I'm blanking. Winkler and, Roberts, sorry, the editors. And I have a chapter in it called the 10 Lessons.
You're talking about Winkleman.
Sorry. Yes. I said Winkler.
Yes.
And Roberts. And so I've got a chapter in there called The 10 Lessons of Psychedelic Psychotherapy Rediscovered. And the rediscovered part has to do with the fact that most of the methodological and clinical insights we've had over the last 60 years working with these materials, you know, like, for example, don't strap them down on a gurney in a psychiatric hospital, you know, setting is important. Those, you know, insights are generally reinventions of the tribal wheel, things that you know, through thousands of years, millennia of trial and error, really, that the tribal peoples really nailed a lot of how to safely and effectively use psychedelics. And so, the 10 lessons rediscovered are Western, you know, lessons and their tribal antecedents. I'll talk a little bit about that later today. So I do psychotherapy with individuals and couples and young people. I do the psychedelic emergency work. I do a lot of phone work with people all around the country. My website, I'll repeat it later, is just my name.com, N-E-A-L, Neil Goldsmith.com. So, you know, anybody's interested, please give me a yell. But that's what I do these days. And I do a lot of public speaking, too. So, you know, I've been speaking a lot about psychedelics. And although I have to give a disclaimer, I don't do any psychedelic psychotherapy. First of all, you know, I'm not qualified to do so because, and it's a policy issue, there's no training programs for psychedelic therapists yet. There's one per medical school. However, you know, so for that reason, but also it's illegal, and although I'd love to be involved with psychedelics clinically, I can't be, and it's too risky to myself and my family. However, you know, I am public on the fact that I have used psychedelics personally, and I found them very helpful to me in my own development and also in development of my practice and in my clinical practice. So while I don't use psychedelics in my clinical practice, they certainly inform my clinical philosophy and my clinical practice in important ways, which I want to talk about also today too. So that's a little bit about me. I went to graduate school out in California, to Claremont Graduate School. I got my master's in counseling at NYU. And then did my policy research doctorate. And when I came back to open up my clinical practice again, I got retrained in, you know, a variety of more Eastern and humanistic traditions like psychosynthesis, for example. So I'm trying to think of what else. So what else would you like to know?
Well, how did you become interested in consciousness and psychedelics? Oh, and I was just going to say, as far as Claremont College, you know, I live about 20 minutes from there.
Oh, you're kidding. No. Well, I went to the graduate school there and in the psychology department, which has a very, very applied orientation. In fact, my degree was in social psychology, and it's called Public Affairs as I call it, doing research that's, basically in the public good. And although we were being trained to essentially be program evaluation research professionals, I became very interested in the issue of research utilization. So, you know, I'd heard all these tales about research reports, consulting reports gathering dust on the shelf, you know, because of the not invented here syndrome. Those are some buzz phrases. And anyway, that just intrigued me because I felt it would be a terrible waste of societal resources to spend money on research and get good data and then have those data not be implemented into policy and practice. It seemed obscene, and it seemed the best leverage point to improve society. So that was the way I focused in. That was my doctoral research, was on research utilization in mental health policymaking. And I, by the way, I don't think any other school but Claremont would, have that specific orientation and allow me to do it. It's just a wonderful school. I did my doctoral research at Princeton, though. As wonderful a school as Claremont was, the psych department was not that supportive, frankly, of doing a study on the utilization of the research they were teaching us to do. Perhaps they felt threatened, but I thought it was a really important topic and ended up going off campus to one of the fathers in the field, Bob Rich, out of Princeton, and worked for him for several years and got my dissertation done.
Would you talk about...
That was a digression about Claremont. You asked me about how I got interested in consciousness and psychedelics. I don't know what it is about me, but I've been interested in consciousness, you know, ever since I was a kid. There's ESP, there's mortality, there's atheism versus does God exist? There's all those sort of topics, ESP, that I was interested in when I was 14 that I'm still interested in. So, I remember I went to India as a college student, and it was in part because of watching, you know, mysterious 1930s movies about India. And so something captured my imagination. The 60s was happening right then. I was, like in 1965, I was about 14 or so. So when everything was really percolating really good, I was too young to be involved, but I observed it, and I read, you know, Time magazine about Bob Dylan and Allen Ginsberg and LSD and Tim Leary. So always interested in those things, but didn't get interested in psychedelics on a personal level, didn't take them until college. Found it quite interesting, but sort of more like intellectual fun and games, if you will. And after college, sort of faded out of that world, got involved with other training and my career and whatnot. And however, I always knew that there was a lot of psychedelics going on because I'd occasionally read in the newspaper about, you know, busts of, you know, 5 million hits of acid or something. And I knew, well, somebody, but it wasn't really me at that point. Then I went into corporate work for a while. And around 40, you know, the midlife crisis kind of age, I guess, I had this wonderful job at American Express Company. I was a vice president of technology strategy. I dealt with internal consulting and change management for emerging technology, artificial intelligence and the web, helping the company become more effective internally by greasing the skids for the introduction of new technology and reducing resistance. So this was a magnificent job. It was corporate headquarters. It was strategic planning. It was, you know, two steps from the chairman, and I, of course, you know, being paid a lot of money. And I just said, gee whiz, what am I doing here? I just started taking psychedelics again. A friend had said to me, have you tried MDMA? This was about 1990, maybe. And so I said, have I tried what? So I went to the library. Interesting, you know, when I was in college taking psychedelics, I took my friend's word for it. But, you know, but this time, you know, I went to the library, went down to the research library, New York Public, and looked up MDMA, and there were like 6 articles on it only. That's it. And there were some fatalities that weren't really associated with MDMA and some others that had to do with heart issues. And I decided it was safe and, you know, took it, and then had a successful trip, really, really successful, I felt, and then went back and said, you know, what else have you got? And this person said, well, I have some LSD. So that was really the first, you know, trip in 20 years I had taken, the LSD trip ultimately. And it was both scary and terrifying, but ultimately quite gratifying, very confirming of what I'd been doing in life, and also gave me a sense of having touched the ground of my being. It was a remarkable experience of going down below my psychological roots and getting down to a place that, you know, when I touched it, made me feel, made me understand that my problems were really just, you know, poignant developmental challenges. And so that was an extraordinary experience. And then that was about 15 years ago, I guess. And at that point, you know, I experimented with settled into mushrooms for the most part, and maybe once a month for quite a while. So that was my reintroduction to psychedelics. But at a certain point, I remember having a conversation and telling somebody about my background in research utilization, somebody in the psychedelics field. And they said, well, that's relevant, isn't it? And it had never oddly occurred to me how incredibly relevant my training, my research utilization training was incredibly relevant to the psychedelics world. Here was, you know, a whole field of research that was valid and reliable and at the very least wildly suggestive of further research. And yet it wasn't implemented into policy or practice. It was basically, you know, buried, a secret. I had never been, the word psychedelics had never been used in my training, in my undergraduate or graduate school training as a psychologist. I was never taught about psychedelics, except perceptual distortion. I was taught about that, for, you know, a little bit about perceptual distortion, but nothing about the research, nothing about the clinical research. That was never mentioned. And when I discovered that there was, you know, like 60 years worth of clinical research out there, or at least, a good 20 years from 47 to 67, you know, undisturbed, wonderful clinical research, peer-reviewed journals. I was astonished, actually. I was amazed. Anyway, so research utilization, you know, obviously applies to psychedelics in spades. And so I've tried since then to do the public speaking part has in part to do with research utilization, getting, you know, disseminating the information, diffusing it out, trusting that the logic of it and the validity of it will grab enough, slowly change. It's viral, actually. And so that's what I try to do a bit too. Yeah. And so, and, you know, we do that at Poetry Science Talks as well. We have a significant subset of what we do. It's not about psychedelics, actually, but there've probably been, I don't know, approximately been doing it for 8 years now. So we've got about, I don't know, 90 or so talks, and probably a dozen of them have been about psychedelics. We had Tom Robertson. We had John Halpernan from Harvard. We've had, we're having our season opener in September will be Steve Ross, Jeff Guss, and Tony Bossio from NYU from the new psilocybin clinical research study with the dying. So, you know, we have a big interest in that area as well.
Would you talk about psychedelic psychotherapy for couples and substance abuse? And since you just mentioned the dying study, you might as well talk about that and toss in some meditative practice in that as well.
Well, you know, that order of topics is really, in a way, significant because it goes from the couple's work is really with normal people. You know, everybody has relationship issues and adjustment issues and compatibility or, you know, working together issues. So what could be more normal than, you know, couples work? And so MDMA has been used in that area. You know, the substance abuse is a little bit more challenging. In fact, it's quite challenging. Substance abuse work is some of the most challenging clinical patients I have. They're the ones who I really wish I could use psychedelics for because substance abuse problems are very difficult to treat. And in fact, back in the, you know, when the research was much more active, it was always about double the normal clinical dose that would be given to, you know, alcoholics because they were much more, much less influenced by the substances. With the dying and meditative practice, you see, it gets, you know, to higher consciousness issues because the work with the dying is existential. And of course, meditative practice, you know, would be sort of spiritual or integral. But, in all of those cases, even with the couple's work, but in particular with substance abuse and the dying and the meditative practice, those are the primary areas of clinical work that have been done over the past, you know, well, like I say, since about 1947. But with all of those, the key issue is the key variable determining successful outcome or not is the peak experience, Maslow's peak experience, the white light experience, ego death, you know, cosmic consciousness. There's so many different words for it. But, you know, if you have a spiritual, transformative spiritual experience, by definition transformative, but, you know, that's what makes you say, oh my God, I've wasted my life, you know, as an alcoholic, or, oh my God, I'm dying. Let me patch up my relationship with my elderly sibling, or, oh my God, you know, meditative practice is just, oh my God. But, you know, this idea of seeing a different way that reality is structured, seeing that there's a substrate reality out of which the material world precipitates. Basically, the key operative variable is the peak experience, white light, ego death, cosmic consciousness, the transformative experience where you realize that there's another underlying subtle reality, substrate reality out of which the material world precipitates. And that realization that there's a ground to our being that is timeless, kind of like what you see in quantum mechanics, a field that's where space and time are not barriers. Well, that's the spiritual world. So we see it whichever way we come at it. And when you see that in a psychedelic, clinical psychedelic research practice, that's the transformative variable. So I think, over the, decades, that issue that realization has emerged.
What are the 10 lessons of psychedelic psychotherapy rediscovered?
Sure. Well, when you think about, you can look through the clinical practice, the clinical research, and you find, a bunch of variables. Basically, Western research has reinvented the wheel of tribal practice. The issue, it's interesting. The FDA talks about the requirement for new drugs to show safety and efficacy. And if you think about tribal practice, that's exactly what ritual does. Ritual instantiates the rules that they've learned through hard practice, through trial and error practice, of what works and what doesn't work. And so what works is efficacious. What doesn't work is frequently an issue of safety. So, so the tribal peoples put together a research program that instead of comparing the variables all at once at the same time, like we do with the control group, nonetheless had a research design, an implicit research design, where they compared the variables chronologically, longitudinally, over time. But there were still comparisons made. Trying something for 100 years, it doesn't work. Well, let's try it the other way for the next 100 years. And over time, something works, and that becomes part of your ritual practice. So it's not surprising, then, that tribal ritual and tribal practice in their use of visionary plants would be rediscovered, essentially, by the West. And we can make that process explicit, essentially reverse engineering tribal practice. So the 10 lessons, and 10 is kind of an arbitrary number. You can slice the world in a lot of different ways, but there's many of them. So the first one you might think of as each drug has its effect. Now, it seems kind of simplistic, but back in the tribal, in the jungle areas, in natural settings, there's a cornucopia of plants out there to be taken, some of which are dangerous, some of which need particular preparation in a certain way. Ayahuasca comes to mind, of course. The anecdote about ayahuasca that is amusing is out of all the hundreds of thousands of plants and combinatorial numbers of how many ways you could prepare them or combine them, how did the tribal folks in South America come to know that you had to prepare, the DMT containing plant in one way and the beta carbolene containing plant in another way, and then combine them so that DMT would be orally active? And they say, well, the mushrooms told us. And so there's something to be. I take that quite seriously because it's a deep web environment that in a holistic way provides a lot of guidance and information. So each drug has its specific effect, and it's extraordinary how expert the tribal societies have been in determining exactly, how to prepare and use these substances. Setting, set and setting are the legacy from the 60s as far as how to do psychedelics. And setting has a strong influence on the state of mind and, of course, thus on outcome. It's the second lesson. It used to be they strapped subjects to the gurneys in psychiatric facilities, and even so, a good chunk of them had mystical experiences like Ken Kesey or Allen Ginsberg. back in the days when they were doing the research at the VA hospitals. The concept of hallucinogen, for example, you know, comes from that era. There's issues of suggestibility as another example. The tribal context is inherently safe. So the webby setting that I described, the embrace of family and friends and tribe mates, making the setting very, very safe and positive, as opposed to, you know, feeling, scared and in an illegal setting. Of course, there are instances in tribal practice where there are fearful or painful practices that are an accepted part of the healing. So that's important to remember. The mindset, the other part, set and setting. So set is mindset. And, you know, setting, I think, is really the willingness, the open-mindedness and the willingness to surrender to the process. It's the most important factor, I believe. It's more important than the type of drug or the dose or the even the setting, one's mindset. But, you know, of course, the setting influences that strongly. The mindset of the tribal folks is naturalistic, accepting. These substances are part of the culture and part of all cultures, really, except ours. Western civilization is pretty much the only culture that hasn't had some sort of visionary plan in its cosmology, in its ritual practices, in its spiritual worldview. Dose is very important, but, you know, obviously can determine a mild or an extreme experience, but it's less important, really, than the other factors, than mindset in particular and setting. It's interesting about the way dose tracks with the intensity of the experience. It's not a direct correlation, but there's lots of things that determine whether the experience goes through, you know, from what, you know, starts, I think it was Masters in Houston, had four different levels of the psychedelic experience. And the first one was more sensory physical, your body and your visuals and the pretty lights and things like that. And I think of that almost like as a veil drawn across the more advanced or sophisticated parts of the psychedelic experience.
Definitely.
Almost to like distract the newbies in a way so that they can become more comfortable with the process before moving forward. But after that is the psychological or the psychohistorical stuff. After that would be the sort of ecological, if you will, or the nature mysticism, the planetary, that sense we have of wholeness. And then the fourth step is that white light experience, ego death, cosmic consciousness, where you dissociate from your body. But what determines how far you go along that continuum? Well, one thing is, yes, dose, of course. Another thing would be the time, both over the evening, you know, as time progresses, you would progress with the drug, but also over the course of your experimentation, over the course of months, you become more relaxed, more open and clear about what's happening for Michael. So there's different ways that these experiences can increase. There's an interesting question about whether ramping up to full dosage over a number of experiences reduces the potential for panic or simply enables the subject to, you know, develop increased defenses. But in general, smaller doses have been used for ongoing psychotherapy, psycholytic psychotherapy, mind loosening, and larger doses have been for more transformative practice. There's a psychedelic approach that includes, you know, periodic big dose, psychedelic doses, interspersed with more ongoing lower doses. But again, tribal practice, very, very specific about, you know, what they take and how much they take. And, they become extraordinary pharmacologists. I'm flipping through because I want to get them all. The preparation and knowledge can enable lasting value. That's lesson number five. We've learned that over time, instead of, again, just strapping them to a gurney with no knowledge of what was happening. Nowadays, they'll be given, you know, subjects will be given reading material, will, you know, become familiar with what's going on. And so, once again, the preparation, not only that, but, you know, the way you eat, for example, having your family around, having your therapist around, those are all, natural to the tribal environment. Ritual, number six, ritual can transmit prior wisdom and guide successful practice. I've mentioned that, and I think that, you know, we in medical research and clinical work in the West, our methodologies and our theoretical frameworks are basically ritual, Western scientific medical ritual. If ritual is the instantiation of hard-won wisdom, then that's what our methodologies are. You know, it's interesting because the psychedelic work nowadays in the West can provide kind of an outlet for, you know, that were formerly met, for needs formerly met by, you know, highly organized, highly ritualized religions like shamanic practices or traditional Catholicism. But, you know, individuals respond differently to ritual. So you don't want to necessarily shove a religious ritual down anyone's throat, but yet there are meta practices, meta protocols for church study groups, for, you know, working with teenagers, newlyweds, you know, things like that. So you know, tribal rituals instantiate the trial and error, and we're doing it too as we do our research. I'm trying to buzz through these. Number seven, support from experienced guides reduces fear and increases benefit. So once again, we've learned that in the West in obvious ways. And one of the proofs of that is the usage of psychedelics in the general public has remained pretty stable at about or so over the years after, you know, the increase in the 60s, I guess, since that time. But admissions to emergency rooms for, you know, emergency treatment of psychedelic experiences has gone down dramatically. So the psychedelic community has learned how to take care of its own. And one of the things that the psychedelic community has learned is about how to get support and how to be guided. So, you know, obviously in the tribal practice, this is your family is there, your parents are there. You know, the whole entire context can be there to guide you. Let's say in a tribal environment, someone has a difficult experience and they're walking around the tribal perimeter, you know, later on the next day and they bump into their uncle. Well, you know, they don't have to hide. The uncle says, what's going on? The young person says, well, you know, yesterday was a little rough. And the uncle says, yes, I was there. I know. How can we help? You know, that sort of thing. So there's no stigma associated with it. Number eight, right. Reentry. And the next two are really, I think, for me, the most important in some ways. Number eight, reentry to a supportive community context aids retention. So, you know, it's the old T-group effect where you go away for an intensive experience to, well, do anything, quit smoking, for example, or a couple's work, some intensive marathon type session. And then, you know, you come back Monday, Friday, you're smoking again or fighting with your wife again because the environment is so important. So, on the other hand, you think of people in the past who've done psychedelics, like I'm thinking of the hippies, who in the 60s turned to communes and got back to the land to get away from urban settings, because I think they felt it was easier to, you know, give root to the insights they would have if they could come back and be with people who supported their goals, their practice. Just again, like in the tribal context, is incredibly supportive, and that's exactly what it is. And it's no coincidence that, you know, the communes of the hippies and, you know, resembled, some of them did, you know, Native American, you know, social configurations. Number nine, accompanying depth psychotherapy, if necessary, and ongoing spiritual practice offer the main opportunity for lasting growth. So once again, you know, psychedelics provide an extraordinary window. For me, it's not a door of perception, but more a window into this world. You know, a really wonderful reaffirmation of the way life works. However, it's, you know, a big experience. Then, you know, you go back to your quote unquote normal life. So if you have a spiritual practice, let's say meditation in particular, some sort of yoga, some other practice that you can do, not episodically with dream results, you know, every month or year, but if you can do every day. So I think, you know, the combination of psychedelics and meditation is perhaps the most effective way to make progress because, you know, psychedelics alone, like I say, without the proper context to reenter into, you know, tend to fade or, you know, get sort of, I guess, distracted, I guess, again, by our personalities. Meditation alone is a long haul. And without that periodic glimpse of your goal, it's meditation, you know, is more difficult and can go off, you know, in blind alleys for years. There's a beautiful meditative story about how meditation and going through life is kind of like climbing a mountain in the fog. The fog isn't dense enough so that you trip over, you know, you can see 2 or 3 feet in front of you, but you can't see the mountaintop. So with psychedelics, you take a psychedelic and the clouds part and you can see the peak of the mountain. You know it's there. And you understand, you know, where you're going, and you have reaffirmation of your intent. And then, of course, the psychedelics go away and the fog comes back. But, you know, and you're back on the path looking 3 feet in front of you, but you know that the mountain peak is in front of you. So anyway, so death psychotherapy as the first part of that is important because psychology is distracting. Because psychology, our personality, gets in the way. Our childhood issues, our egos, which of course is not our whole self, not even our most fundamental self. And so when we're in the grip of our personality or our psychology, it's distracting. And so that often needs to be dealt with first, to be cleared and relaxed, like a knot in your psychological muscle that can now be relaxed through love, really, through acceptance, through compassion that one gets through psychedelics, I think, or other ways, of course. But relaxing those knots, those psychological knots in one's history, then clears, I think, the vision, really, for introspection, to clears you to see down to the bottom, to the ground of your being. And so, of course, you know, in the tribal environment, spiritual practice is already a deep part of tribal life, both before, during, and after any psychedelic rite. So new development is, you know, more readily integrated into this pre-existing fabric of self in culture, in nature. And the last lesson, the 10th, was the revised worldview is both a requirement for and a result of integrated psychedelic practice. So, you know, there's a transformation taking place, not just in individuals who take psychedelics, but in society. You know, we're now in the second round of psychedelic research, you know, the first from the 40s on, and then now again since the early 90s. And now it's been a different process. It's been a little smoother, a lot more smooth, and there's been a lot less outcry. There's still raves going on and things like that, but it hasn't really derailed the research because it's not really associated with the research. The research has been impeccable. And so it's a different world now. But still in all, when you think about the insights of psychedelics, this peak experience variable I keep talking about, or white light or ego death, that's not a medical or a chemical, primarily chemical experience, although it's neurological, of course, but it's spiritual. And so, when you have an area of medical practice where the medicine, is spiritual, is a spiritual experience. It's not like penicillin, or insulin. It's, you know, this is, the triggering of a spiritual experience is what gets you your clinical outcome. With that, truth, being, impossible to hide from, it has to stretch the boundaries of medicine, of the definition of medicine, of the definition of science. It's like I was talking about earlier about my salon poetry science talks, the integral sweet spot between, you know, the incommensurate and the spiritual on the one hand and the material on the other. Well, that's exactly what's happening in medical practice, because psychedelics is a wedge issue that forces medicine to look at how healing takes place. What's the body really? You know, what about holistic approaches, holism in terms of gestalt, the gestalt of the body, the sum being, the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. Those are sorts of issues that are postmodern or integral issues that are little pre glimpses of the new societal realignment that we're moving toward. And that psychedelics, I think, are playing an integral part on the individual and also on the societal level. But it's interesting how, so therefore they're transformative, of course, but they're also, it requires a transformation in our society to embrace them. So it's kind of like a bootstrapping thing where It's an interesting sort of cosmic truth of the postmodern future that, you know, these substances both require and engender, you know, transformation. So those are the 10. Those are the 10 lessons. But you know, it's a wonderful spiral of development, I think, where you start out with a deeply spiritual, integrated life in a tribal setting. But without, you know, but yeah, you die when you're 30 from an infection. And so there's a natural inclination, of course, to use the frontal lobes, the frontal lobe eye fingers, you know, coordinated as a system to change the world, to, you know, to build buildings and Western civilization. And why not? Well, you know, of course, we're going to live to be 90 now. But the price, it's a devil's bargain. The price is alienation from our tribal, our natural setting in which we evolved, in which is really our natural context. So, well, what's the solution? You know, we can't go down the curve, down the spiral like Bin Laden or the Unabomber wanted us to do. We're going to power through, and we're going to keep on going around that spiral, up, you know, 360 degrees around to right where we were with the tribal setting, but up one level, with our eyes open, Buddhist right. style this time. So that's the process I think we're going through, and psychedelics facilitates it, you know, for our society.
What are the 5 thorny theoretical and methodological questions in psychedelic research and practice that you read about?
Yes. Okay. Well, you know, it turns out we've been doing this research for quite a while, and there are some very interesting sort of state-of-the-art issues that have cropped up. So one of them is the issue of psychedelics and self-experimentation. And the famous example nowadays is Sasha Shulgin. Alexander Shulgin is the pharmacologist, the psychopharmacologist who, and chemist who creates novel psychedelics and has created hundreds of them. And, well, how do you know if it's the psychedelic? How do you know if it's the, well, you know, he will take a substance that, a chemical that, a structurally related chemical produced a certain type of an effect. And then he will titrate. He'll tweak it in a certain way chemically, add something from another chemical, from another molecule perhaps, and titrate down to the smallest conceivable dose, maybe a thousandth or a hundredth of what the related chemical was active at. And typically we'll feel nothing. And a week later try some multiple of that and move his way up very, very slowly and carefully through titration to the point where he first feels something at all. When he feels something at all, then he convenes his group. This is past history, of course. This group is no longer working, to my knowledge. But this was the way he tested the drugs, and he would give them to people and say, "Well, you know, the related drug was active at 100 milligrams. I'm going to take 100 milligrams," and everybody in the group would decide what they wanted to do and how much. I had a little hard time last month, so I'm going to take a little less. Or whatever it might be. And their only requirement was to write up a trip report. Now, it sounds kind of casual and in some way, but, you know, setting, they don't strap you down to gurneys anymore. So, okay, now it's a nice, homey, loving, relaxed, safe setting. That's very effective. So Sasha's self-experimentation group, you know, satisfies that part, requirement for modern psychedelics research, something safe, safe setting, that is. And the anecdotal reports, the trip reports that come up, formed the foundation for his research papers that he would submit. Because after all, you know, when you're first studying a drug, you don't have 50,000 subjects. You have 5 or 10. And so he's published enormously influential research, as well as Pical and Tikal books that are compendiums of his findings. But the point being that it's all self-experimentation. And back in the turn of the century, when, you know, Hefter and Louis Lewin were dealing with mescaline and trying to get mescaline out of peyote and study it in the laboratory, again, you had to experiment on yourself. There's no way to, you know, you can give a psychedelic substance to a laboratory animal, and if they stare at the wall for 8 hours, you don't know if they're having a psychedelic experience or not. So human self-experimentation researchers need to be permitted to do self-experimentation again. It's a very rigorous, too rigid scientific structure now that makes it difficult to do that. The second lesson is why redo psychedelic research already conducted in the 50s and 60s. When the government opened up the proscription against doing psychedelics research in the early 90s, they made the researchers who applied to do research with psychedelics go back and do the basic chemistry work, the basic dose response studies, the safety and efficacy studies, safety studies, I should say, initially. And the reason was, and it was important to do so, because the methodology back in the 50s was very crude compared to what we do today, not just in terms of technology, but also in clinical work in terms of ethics. For example, doing research with prisoners or with the dying without very careful prescription. So, you know, the research done basically from the 50s and 60s sort of had to be just thrown out or redone or reestablished. Not that it was all bad, and frankly, most of it's been reaffirmed. But nonetheless, the government was playing it safe, maybe dragging their heels a little bit. But, you know, it's been 15 years now, and now those safety studies have been done again. And now the clinical studies are happening. So so it was important, I think, to redo that, not just because I think for political reasons, for sort of psychological political reasons that everybody felt comfortable, everybody was covering their butts, and so now their butts are covered. The research is impeccable. The safety studies have been done. And now the clinical work can proceed, you know, on a firm ground. And indeed, the research is being accepted. Number three issue, can psychedelics provide a lasting cure? You know, there's this internist back in the 19th century, Armand Trousseau, who had this wonderful quote, use new drugs quickly while they still work. And so there's something about the psychosomatic, about all drugs, and belief in the drug and the authority of the institution, the doctors, is an important part of outcome. And by the way, I'm not poo-pooing that, because I think there should be, you know, institutes of clinical studies, institutes of placebo, institutes of that sort of thing. So there's nothing wrong with the placebo effect. We should make use of it if we possibly can. But can psychedelics provide a lasting cure? Well, typically not. I mean, there's transformative experiences, of course, and by definition, those are transformative over a lifetime. But, you know, the clinical literature sort of shows that if you do a study with alcoholics and you find some really good significant results, on, you know, getting off the wagon, getting on the wagon, I should say. And then you find, you know, in 6 months' time, the results are significant. Well, you know, I'm generalizing, but, you know, in 2 years' time, many people have fallen off the wagon and the results are no longer significant. So, you know, some opponents have used that as evidence that, you know, the drugs don't work. But in reality, of course, they work for 6 months. And there are many drugs that don't work forever. I mean, you know, insulin is a good example. You know, you got to take it all the time. And no one expects penicillin to work in one dose. So there's nothing wrong with the concept of booster shots. So can psychedelics provide a lasting cure? Well, you know, sure, but why not design our clinical policies, our research policies, around the reality of the situation, which is that these substances need to be integrated into society. You know, the Native American Church is an example. You know, they don't do peyote once. It's not like that. They do it frequently, on a monthly basis, perhaps, or more. It's part integrated into their society. Same thing with the ayahuasca churches, the Santo Daime and the Unidad de Vegetal, which now are both recently permitted to practice in the U.S. And don't require, by the way, native blood. So it's not like the Native American Church, where I think you have to be a quarter Native American to participate in the UDMs. The U.S. branches, you don't. But all of those examples, you know, give a good hint as to the way psychedelics are to be used. And the magic bullet, you know, one-shot sort of psychedelic approach of seeing God and being cured isn't really the way it's used. You know, psychedelics are most effectively used, I believe. So related to that is the fifth question. Can psychedelics induce real spirituality? So, you know, that's a debate that's been going on, you know, as long as the West has been looking at the use of visionary plants and psychedelic chemicals.
Tom, Tom Roberts, I was going to say, Tom Roberts did a whole book on that topic.
He did indeed. And, you know, Huxley talked about it and had a big debate with Zahner, who claimed that it was just ersatz spirituality, that it was, you know, at best nature mysticism, which is kind of like a lesser form of spirituality.
Right.
And then, you
yeah.
know, Walter Pontet at Harvard, you know.
Yeah.
Walter Pontet at Harvard did that wonderful Marsh Chapel study with the divinity students, where, you know, he found significant religious experience based on a survey created by a philosopher of religion who had nothing to do with psychedelics to try to identify what a true mystical experience would be. And he gave those variables plus two, he added two X and found significant results. And then, of course, Rick Doblin did a follow-up study 20 years later and found that the results were still significant in the individuals, you know, 20 years later. So, you know, is it real spirituality? You know, gosh, that's a debate that brings you down to the fundamental notion of reality. You know, is chemical, are the effects in the brain, the chemical the processes in the brain, are they real? The way I would put it, it brings us back down to the idea that there's not this duality between, you know, mystical, spiritual, abstract, supernatural on the one hand, and the brain and physiology and neurochemistry and structure activity relationships and serotonin on the other hand. It's not like that. There's not two things. It's only one thing. And you can approach, it's like the three blind men with the elephant. You know, you can approach it from one perspective or from the other perspective, but there's only one reality. So the idea of, you know, questioning whether it induces real spirituality because it's a chemical is really sort of silly, I think, in a way, because if you take a look at people while they're meditating and check their blood or when they have mystical experiences, do brain scans, once again, you find brain, you know, underlying brain activity reflecting exactly what's happening in the spiritual realm. So ultimately, I think the question is sort of serious.
Not only that, but you have, endogenous levels of dimethyltryptamine and 5-methoxydimethyltryptamine in the lungs, blood, and cerebral spinal fluid. So, you know, then it poses a whole other question. If we have these substances endogenously, then is meditating only manipulating certain levels of that? But I was going to add that one thing I'll often take it to is the point that, you know, these plants that we're taking that are supposedly outside of ourselves, if these plants didn't exist, if all of nature didn't exist, how long would we be alive to even argue against these plant substances for the experience? You know, it's if the plants give us life, is it therefore that far of a stretch of the imagination to suggest that they give us our consciousness as well?
It's really well put. I mean, after all, it's a co-evolution. The entire biosphere is a co-evolution, and certainly, you know, humans and visionary plants have been a subset of that. There's lots of different ways to create the mystical experience, if you will. Drugs and fasting, mortification of the flesh, self-flagellation, a trance, dancing, drumming, mantras, you know, breathing exercises, wakefulness, sensory deprivation, carbon dioxide, you know, all of them produce this profound mystical experience. And really, you know, in a way, you can say, well, what's going on right now in your mind? Is it chemistry, you know, or is it will? Well, I don't want to distinguish between those two. I don't distinguish between those two. It's the substrate and the sort of manifest or the precipitate, and they're just two sides of the same coin. So if we're really moving to an integral worldview where chemistry and spirituality are seen as sort of mirrored perspectives on our essential wholeness, then we're moving also to a world where medicines are used not only to heal sickness, but also to facilitate personal growth among the healthy. And so, you know, the baby boomers are going to push that, but not just nootropics, but also psychedelics, especially, you know, as I think is the baby boomers begin to die. And it's happening now. The interest in psychedelic psychotherapy for the dying is one of the primary research areas. So one last thing about that. If the peak experience variable is indeed the operative one, then, you know, we have to also ask the question of whether these substances are, you know, best used in medical practice or in spiritual practice. Of entheogens, not psychedelics, if you will. A different name for the same thing, but reflects.
Well, it's like Bob Jester. Tom Roberts says the entheogenic use of psychedelics.
Exactly right. And his partner in CSP, the Council on Spiritual Practices, is Bob Jesse. And, you know, Tom is a co-founder of CSP. And CSP's goal is to encourage the use of psychedelics by church groups and without the medical context, without the need really for medical supervision. There was actually one more thorny question, if I will, you know, which has to do with why do psychedelics give pain relief? It's really interesting because in the early 60s, there was a oncologist named Eric Kast, K-A-S-T, who was working at the University of Chicago Medical School. And he had heard about this new thing, LSD, 62, 63, 64, and he decided he was going to give it to his cancer patients and see if it would give pain relief. It was just a fishing expedition. And so he gave it. And it was the results were extraordinary. The patients who had peak experience had analgesic effects lasting up to 2 weeks. 2 weeks, you know, it's clearly not a chemical effect. No chemical will give you pain relief for that long. You know, the opiates last, you know, 6, 12, whatever hours, and the pain relief from having taken LSD lasted 2 weeks, up to 2 weeks. And so he was astonished and continued that line of research. But, you know, he explained it as what he called the attenuation of anticipation, that when people are not so caught up in the fear of death, the existential anxiety of facing death, when they see God and they can relax because they know they're safe and they're going to be okay and they know the universe is about love, when they can relax like that, then they can release the tension and the physical pain that they're holding onto in their bodies. Because in this culture, it's more acceptable to cry out for physical pain than to cry out for existential pain. So the thought is that there's a lot of the existential pain that's transposed into bodily pain, and that's released through the use of psychedelics. And the folks at Spring Grove, which was kind of the last man standing, the last research program, standing in the 70s, really. They didn't stop their research until 76, I believe. They were the most sophisticated research program, and they came up really also with the issue of peak experience as the operative variable.
That's some fascinating stuff, and that's exactly Groff goes into that whole thing about that peak experience.
Being exactly. And Panty was there too.
Right, exactly. And, and from my own experience personally with these things, that seems to be the key factor as well. And, you know, not only that, but having experiences like, telepathy with other people is quite startling and healing experience when you suddenly realize that, your thoughts aren't so private.
That stuff that's reported frequently.
Oh, yeah, you know, and I've not just had that experience once or twice, but I would say I've had it upwards of 30 or more times. And
wow.
with many different people in situations where people were in different rooms and doors were closed, and in all instances, the experience was verified via speech afterwards and said, hey, did we just experience some right. weird phenomena there? And yeah, did you just experience, did I just think that I was thirsty and you got up to get me a glass of water? Yeah.
Right. Did I say that or just think that?
Right, exactly.
Well, you know, it's funny because, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to, you know, you wonder, you know, why the hell does that happen? You know, how does psychedelics bring us into this, you know, kind of funky area of research of ESP? Well, I think it's not funky at all, really. I think it makes perfect sense because if you look at the universe, it's funny. You look at the smallest scale, it's quantum mechanics. At the smallest right. scale of the universe, you know, the things operate in a very psychedelic way. There's, you know,
well,
issues of time
you know,
and space.
Well, not only that, but you get into things like Rick Strassman talks about it. What is it? 96% of the universe is made up of dark matter. So what the hell is that? We don't even know what's there.
Exactly.
And to assume that the other 4% is all there is, it's like you said, you know, looking at the feeling the tail of an elephant, the three blind men story. But nobody is feeling the elephants. I don't know. The nobody
Listen,
realizes
you know
that they're in an elephant's pen or something because there's all this dark matter there that.
That's funny.
Go ahead. Anyway.
That's funny. Yes. No, that's true. Look, you know, you made my point for me because not just at the microscopic level, but also at the macroscopic level of cosmology and relativity, things are wacky. They're not linear. They're not Newtonian. They're not cause and effect. You know, things at the relativistic level with time dilation and all sorts of stuff like that are counterintuitive. They're not step-by-step rationalogical. Now, so people say, yeah, but in the middle, you know, not at the subatomic level and not at the universal level, but at the human scale level, things are Newtonian. Things are mechanistic. Things are, you know, cause and effect. No, take a look at Buddhism. Buddhism is operant in the middle level. And Buddhist practice tells you something very different, that the middle level of our normal day-to-day life is indeed more like quantum mechanics and relativity than, you know, than we like to think. That there's different levels of reality, the physical level being only the beginning, really. And I use the chakras as a good developmental model, both for individuals, you know, through their lives, but also for the species as we move forward, as we move forward.
And with that, how have your own, which you mentioned earlier, psychedelic experiences affected your psychology practice? I know that's had to have had a tremendous impact on your work.
Well, well, first of all, you know, when I was trained before I went back and got my doctorate at the master's level, I have a counseling psychology degree from NYU. I was trained in Rogerian therapy, which is one of those annoying types of therapy where the doctor just kind of repeats what you have to say with some slight variation. And, you know, like I say, then I left that work and went back and did the planning work and whatnot and came back out with a doctorate and ultimately opened my clinical practice again. And at that point, having taken psychedelics, it was the opposite. So instead of just, you know, repeating what people said, I'm there. I am so present in what I do. And so that's just in terms of, you know, my relationship with my clients is deep, and I love my clients. I call them clients, by the way, not patients, because the medical model for me is really part of the problem. You know, looking at normal, you know, like neurosis, this word neurosis really bugs me because, you know, it's like when I was in college, in one of my early psychology courses, I asked the teacher, oh, what, you know, if you have neurosis, can you get psychosis? And they said, no, they're not related that way. But, you know, they're not related really in a lot of ways. They're not related at all. Just because they rhyme, that they both have osis at the end. And they are clinical diagnoses. Neurosis is a clinical diagnosis, and it seems scientific. But in reality, to me, it's the medicalization of a natural process. You know, everybody's got neurosis to varying degrees. Everybody's got it. If everybody's got it, it's not pathology. You know, it's like E. coli.
Neil, are you neurotic?
You know, it's yeah. But you know, I don't like the word. What I would call it is immature. I don't use the word neurosis. So, so for me, you know, it's about development, and we're all developing along those chakra levels from infancy to wisdom, and that's a natural process. It's not one that happens smoothly, though. It's not a slope. It's a step. It's stepwise.
So are you saying that Are you saying that when we were 16 years old and thought we knew everything, that we really didn't know shit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm saying when we were 16, we were 16. And we knew what we were supposed to be knowing. And whatever we were grappling with was beautiful. Because, you know, listen, my model is my son. I have a 10-year-old son. But when he was learning to walk, when he was about one, he used to fall on his butt all the time, you know, like any kid learning to walk will do. And he'd turn around and he'd look at me with this quizzical look on his face, like, what just happened, Dad? Is that okay? And I would smile. He'd be beaming, you know, because I would just love what he was up to. And he'd fall. I'd clap. I would clap. Now, I wasn't clapping for his, quote-unquote, failure, for him falling. No, of course, I was clapping for his effort, you know, the process he was involved in, everything. And he would smile and, you know, kind of like try again. And if I didn't doubt when he fell and called the pediatrician, you know, it would have been a different situation. Because I knew it was fall, 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 walk. And that falling was sort of failure on the way to mastery, and therefore wasn't failure at all. And so now, if you, you know, fast forward, you know, 20 years to my clients come in, they say, oh, I can't keep a relationship. And I kind of smile because it's failed relationship, failed relationship, failed relationship, successful relationship. And that's developmental. So if you go to most psychologists, they'll talk to you in pathological terms, that they'll say, look, you know, you're sick in this way. Here's your diagnosis. And if you do what I say and follow my instructions and take these drugs, you know, these pharmaceuticals, then at a certain time in the future, you'll be okay. Yeah. Well, that's exactly what parents say. That's what parents say. Parents say, look, you know, I love you in this way, you're fine. I love you in this way, you're fine. I love you in this way, you're fine. This way, no, that has to change. Now, the parents are talking to the child, but it's really from them, because something about their personality gets triggered. Some, you know, issue from their child gets triggered by the parent, by the child acting in this way. But nonetheless, it's to the child. You got to change in this way. So the child feels this is not, you know, this part of me is not good. This, I have to be different. And tries again. Oh, wait a minute. You don't understand, the child, in essence. Love me. No, this is me. This is natural. You know, this is cool. Let me show you. No. I'm sorry. No. And if you persist, I'm either going to withdraw my love and get cold, or I'm going to get angry. But either way, it's off-center parenting, skewed right or left, too hot or too cold. Right in the center is that beautiful sweet spot. So the child eventually says, in essence, well, this isn't working. I'm going to punt to plan B, personality. So you wanted me to be what? Funny, smart, compliant, sexy, you know, whatever, you know, artistic, whatever the parent was sort of putting like a template into the child now conforms to that template, and that becomes personality. So now the child is, you know, in that area of life, they're that way. But their true self, of course, is stunted, is buried, because it hurts. You know, it hurts to push up and say, I want to be, here I am, and have the parent not accept it with joy and love and nurturance and cherishing it. So you know, the child, the pain of that gets buried. And the personality instead is where we put our consciousness. We don't identify anymore with the true self, the part that's now, you know, a painful experience that's buried. We identify instead with the shell, the outside part, the personality. And we go through life. But realize this process happens when the child, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years of age. So personality is a strategy designed by a baby. It's not meant to be effective in adulthood. You know, it's just a stopgap measure, really. The personality, the ego, is really not meant to carry all the baggage from, you know, childhood trauma. It's meant to be a way to interface with the world, the physical world, you know, getting things done and stuff. But, you know, because it's effective, we sort of throw our personality into it. At least we'll be safe and effective there. We sort of hijack ego to, you know, reside in. But so the process of change and the process of psychedelics really is one of getting down to the ground of our being and seeing what's underneath, you know, the personality, seeing the true self, the original self. So listen, I wrote a poem, a short poem that I'd like to read to you, which sort of captures the essence of what I'm trying to describe now. And it's about psychedelic experience, but it's really about personality too. Sure. It's called Mist, Mist. I feel in a mist, sleepwalking through life, sleep talking with other sleepwalkers, triggering out my insides. On the other hand, I float down to the ground of my being, and on the way down, I cry my childhood into completion. On the ground, a glowing mound throbs, emanating peace. I touch the glowing orb, and my sleeping seed awakens, reigniting the unfolding frozen so long ago, unfolding unto the sun, upward to the warmth of love, from the glow to the warmth.
Very nice.
So that poem kind of reflects my personality theory, and my image of personality structure. And it really comes from my own psychedelic practice. But of course, I apply it then to my clinical practice. You know, I ask my clients to meditate. We talk about personality formation and how it's only natural that a baby, a toddler, under the influence of two huge superhuman gods, mommy and daddy, the 2-year-old does not have the resources to say, mom and dad, you know, the parenting isn't good. And unless you kind of love me more, I'm going to move out. And, I got a job and babies have no money, no car, no concept of life outside of the home. They are overwhelmed by the implication of what the parents, childhood experiences is leading them to do to the child. So, of course, the parents are right. But it's Darwinian. This is like about, love, being loved means being safe. And being safe means survival. So, you got to be loved. And if you're not going to be loved, you're going to, like I say, do with the parent. You're going to comply. But even being compliant is really, passive aggressive, because the personality, the true self, keeps wanting to come out. So, it works its way into relationships too, because, your parent tells you in this area, you're not good. You take that inside and you struggle. I'm not good, you internalize the critical parental voice. And the part of you that feels terrible gets buried. When you get into a relationship, the part of you that feels terrible that's buried, you project that onto your partner. So now they're the bad one, and you're the one pointing the finger. So, in relationship work, you have to take that projection of the duality between you and your spouse back inside to become an internal duality between your internalized parental voice and your feeling bad about yourself inside. Continue the reverse engineering, figuring out where the heck that came from, and recognize that the duality is really from outside of you, again, between you and your parent, and then releasing it. Because now that you're an adult, you can go back and see it differently, view it with, it's still painful, of course, but it's not scary. It's no longer a matter of life and death, because now you do have a car, and you do have a job, and you do have friends, and you can, it's not a, being unloved is no longer a potentially fatal. And to me, the difference between in childhood, pain and fear coming together, whereas when we allow ourselves through relaxation, through redefinition of it as a natural developmental process rather than pathology, that we allow ourselves to go in and look more carefully as an adult, to open up the basement door and turn on the lights and air things out, that we see that, well, yes, it's still painful not to have proper parenting, not to be loved properly, but it's not scary anymore. And so it's reincorporatable. So that experience happens through psychedelics. So anyway, so we awaken to this process in adulthood. The childhood strategy isn't working. We have to disidentify with our personality, the shell, the defensive, the acquired, the strategic personality, and re-identify with the perfect core. Relaxing those knots in the psychological muscle. And so, honesty and presence in the therapeutic relationship is key to that. And once again, it's the only way I'd want to practice is if I could be myself. And so it's Sander Ferenczi, who's a disciple of my model in this area. But, you know, of course, issues of transference and countertransference and boundaries come up when you're present and real, and being wrong, by the way, too. I mean, I've been that a lot. So even being wrong is good because, you know, at least I'm out there and honest and sincere, and then we can work together to figure out what the actual truth is. But meanwhile, so my question then becomes, in my practice, both my psychedelic practice and my clinical practice, is change really, you know, the proper goal? Because, you know, clients come in all the time. They say they want to get better. I think, well, better than what? Your actual self? That's what their parents told them to do. So the idea of trying to change, to fix it, to get better, to be more effective, to be more something, to be more, to be gooder, sorry, that's parents talking. So in my work, it's funny, I don't help them to change or to get better. Getting better is a medical term, and they're not sick. I help them to evolve, to mature. But change, fixing things, you know, working on yourself doesn't work. So it's a matter of, it's an Ayurvedic perspective, a perfect, healthy, developmental maturation process. It's about the integration of body and mind and spirit. These are all psychedelic things. It's like a seed going through developmental stages to wisdom. It's not medical. It's a natural unfolding. The centrality of love, safety in infancy is really important. One of my taglines on one of my brochures is, neurosis is the natural unfolding of human maturation. In other words, what we call neurosis is actually just the wall or the challenge or the hurdle, the surmounting of which reflects wisdom, reflects maturity. So how can the wall be pathology? It's just a challenge. So anyway, so I really conclude that the desire for change is really a reflection of the problem, not of the solution.
I find your approach there very fascinating. Just listening to you talk there and just approaching the whole issue as from the maturity angle, instead of prescribing a drug or labeling it as some narcosis or not narcosis, neurosis or psychosis, and that seems to be a very unique perspective compared to many or most or all of the others I've heard out there in psychotherapy. So I applaud you for that.
You know, I was not encumbered.
Go ahead.
I was completely open to integrating the insights I got through my own spiritual experiences, my own, you know, my own life, my own readings, my own psychedelic experiences with my clinical practice. I'm not really, there's one methodology that I use, which is Imago Relationship Therapy. It's spelled Imago, and it's a spectacularly effective tool. And I use that method pretty, even that I use eclectically, but I do use it. Whereas in other areas, I don't use many technique in my practice. I find that it's the most effective variable for me in my clinical practice is trust, relationship, safety, so that the patient, the client, can go deeper. To me, that's the operative variable. It doesn't really matter what methodology one uses. There are certain methodologies in psychology that are more effective for certain disorders, I don't even want to call it that, but certain issues, it's true. But in general, there's less effect of school of thought or specific methodology than there is in terms of relationship. Match of socioeconomic status between, you know, client and therapist is very important. And in particular, and that's because of bonding, because of trust, because of empathy. Those are the operative variables, just like the peak experience is the operative variable, actually, in psychedelic research.
Let me ask you how your trip at Burning Man, your experience at Burning Man, affected your work.
Absolutely. So, Burning Man, really so interesting and so educational for me personally and also in my practice, because it speaks to exactly this issue about change. So first of all, let me back up a little bit and tell you about this, you know, how I tend to trip, because, you know, what, how I set it up and for benefit. It's the setting and the mindset aspect, I guess. Typically when I was a kid in college, I would trip with my friends and we'd stay up all night and talk and listen to music. And it was, you know, it was great, but it only went so far. In a way, it didn't go much further than those four levels I talked about before. The first was the sensory visual and the second was the psychological. And it didn't really go much further than those two, with a little twinges of nature mysticism, perhaps. You know, 20 years later, when I started again, it was very different. I was, you know, in my 40s, I was older, it's different. I always tripped alone. And I would take only modest doses because I'd be scared of, you know, I don't know, being alone really with the dose, but maybe, you know, 3 or 4 grams of mushrooms, something like that, a modest dose. And I would always cry. I would always go inside. It would always be meditative. I'd curl up in either bed or on a couch with a blanket and really go inside. And deal a lot, really primarily with psychological issues. It was always, you know, I don't know about my childhood and things like that. And that was the kind of tripping I did. However, what happened, you know, that poem I read is indicative of, you know, going down to the ground of my being. And the way I really first did that on one of my early trips was I had this wonderful experience as I got further and further into the, at the beginning of the trip, as I got further into it, I felt like I was sinking underground. And as I finally went actually underground, I saw my roots. I could see underground in this visual image, my roots. And it was the beginning of the experience. And I thought with my still partially straight mind, I said, oh, great, I'll go fix things. Let me go look at my roots. And as I kind of zoomed in my mind's eye to go pick on my roots went and recoiled from my, you know, scrutiny. And it really made me feel, you know, kind of unsettled. So I turned the other way. I said, all right, come back to you later. And went down, down, down to that throbbing orb I described. So when I touched it, I realized that, you know, my problems were really just, you know, poignant psychological challenges, developments, and not, you know, problems really or sicknesses. And when I came back up and looked at those roots again with that kind of compassionate view and, oh, it's okay. My, you know, however I am, however my roots are, it's okay. I understand. Then my roots went, and opened back up. So, you know, that experience was kind of the way I would take psychedelics. In other words, I really wouldn't focus so much on the problems or the issues, you know, at the beginning. I would instead get to a point of kind of like of transcendence, a feeling of love. And when I felt that, when I really felt that universal love, you know, I thought that was just perfect. And then I could, you know, really look at my problems and cry about my childhood and whatever. And those were the sorts of trips I had. But, although I learned an enormous amount and the feeling of transcendent love was profoundly, educational, I can't really call it transformative because after these experiences, I'd feel wonderful. I'd be rededicated to my life, to what was important to me in life, you know, remember why I was doing what I was doing. But, you know, a week or two later, like memory metal, you know, my personality would pop back into place and the peace or insight that I'd had would, you know, would fade, even with, you know, supportive spiritual practice. So at Burning Man, it was very, very different. And of all the different trips I've taken, there really has been, in my experience, only one that was transformative. And that was the one I took at Burning Man. So what happened at Burning Man was Rick Doblin, who's the founder of MAPS,
right,
the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, and the best, you know, MAPS.org, the best organization for looking at the research and the policy that exists. And Rick has been probably the single most influential individual in creating the psychedelic renaissance in the past 20 years.
I interviewed him on the show about 4 months ago.
Well, you know, he deserves an enormous credit. Anyway, so Rick asked me to come down to volunteer at Sanctuary, and I didn't want to go because it was too dusty, you know. So I didn't go, and he, you know, cajoled me again, and finally I went. And I just, you know, Burning Man, for those who've been there know, but it's a land of extremes. Extreme, you know, discomfort and pain and dust and heat and, you know, discomfort, and extreme love and dharma and joy and selflessness and family. I mean, it just, it couldn't be more extreme. Just wonderful. And so the folks at Sanctuary are wonderful too. And so it was an extreme, just a lovely experience. While I was there, somebody approached me and said, you know, in addition to the emergency work at Sanctuary, there's also intentional work going on where people are, you know, helping others. Would you like to participate in that and help others? And I said, you know, I would really love to do that. That would be an extraordinary challenge. But, you know, what I'd really like to do is be the client. I'd really love to do that because, like I said, you know, I take modest doses, but, you know, because I'm alone. So this would be an opportunity to be with, you know, in a context that was guided. So indeed, that's what I did. So I took a larger dose, and I had two people with me helping me. One was a male underground therapist who I've known for 20 years and trust and love. And the other was a female psychiatrist who works with psychedelics in Canada, who I had just met, but who was maternal and loving and safe and just great. So I had this great, you know, team. So I started, you know, getting ready. You know, we took the drugs and the mushrooms and started to come onto the experience. And they said, well, okay, you know, what do you want to talk about? Or we started, I said, listen, let me tell you first about the way I trip. I said, you know, there's this like glowing orb and this ground of my being, and, you know, I touch it and I feel loving, and then everything's just a poignant developmental challenge. And, you know, then I look at my problem. So, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go inside. I'm going to go do that process. I'll be about it, you know, an hour, and then I'll come back up and then we'll start working. And so they looked at each other and then they looked at me and they said, no, go there now. And I said, no, wait, you don't understand. Let me tell you again, you know, there's this glowing orb and it's really peaceful and blah, blah. And they said, go there now. And I resisted for like probably 45 minutes, or at least what seemed like 45 minutes. And, you know, I got pissed at them after a while. I got really annoyed that they didn't understand how important this was and how I had to educate them. And, you know, it was really interesting how defensive I was. And ultimately, they started getting a little bit annoyed. And I realized, well, you know, the last thing you want to have when you're in a psychedelic psychotherapy situation is to have your psychedelic psychotherapist pissed off at you. So I finally relaxed and just said, okay, you know, I surrendered the process. What should I do? They said, go there now. I said, okay. So I closed my eyes, and this is about my mother. This is about my childhood. My mother, you know, loving my brother more than she loves me. You know, everybody's got their own story. Mine is not, you know, unique. Mine is not unique, but right. It's obviously, you know, very, very, been very, very influential in my life. So I didn't want to go there. So I close my eyes. I go down to that area. And as I get close to it, I come back up again. I open my eyes. I try one more time. I said, it's like a black hole. You know, there's an event horizon. I can orbit at the event horizon. I've done it many times. And I can tell you all about the pain. You know, there's no need to go there. It's really painful, and I understand it really well. So let me just tell you about it. Go there now, they said. So I closed my eyes again, and I went down there. And, man, I went down, and I went and just re-experienced the experience of not being loved the right way, you know, enough, what have you, as much. Whatever my issue was, I experienced it directly as I had the first time. I mean, you know, I had never experienced it that much since it was happening to me as a baby. And boy, did I cry. And so I got angry too, because at that, you know, I came up and I looked at them. I said, you know, so what do I do with the pain? I was crying. I said, what do I do with the pain? Like, you know, you dopes, I told you this was going to happen. I told you it was going to be painful. So she looked at me and she said, you know, Neil, let me ask you a question. Did you die? And all of a sudden, it all just really came clear. Because I've told my clients that many times, that, you know, that when you're a baby, you know, it's overwhelming. You can't accept it. But, like I said before, it's painful, but it's no longer life-threatening. It's no longer scary. it's no longer a matter of life and death. And so now, you know, that period, that my childhood experience is available to me. It's sort of like I was living on a three-legged chair, you know, four-legged chair with one leg missing. And if I leaned in this direction, I was okay. If I talked about the present, it was okay. If I leaned back and talked about this aspect of my past, no problem. If I leaned back and talked about or wanted to think about my relationship with my mom, whoa, you know, unstable. So now I have the fourth leg back. So my foundation is broader. So that experience for me, and then, of course, coming home and interacting with my family, forgiving my brother, you know, at Burning Man, they burn the statue of the Burning Man on Saturday night. But there's a second burning on Sunday night, you know, the last, at the end of the week, of the Temple of Forgiveness. And the Temple of Forgiveness is this wooden structure that's quite big, like big as a house, really. And on every square inch is posted up, you know, notes, photographs, messages written on pen in the wood. It all gets burnt on Sunday. You know, Joe, I forgive you. Mary, sorry you couldn't be with us. You know, somebody, you know, like 1960 to 1997, you know, they died. You know, I'll always love you. Daddy, you know, we miss you. Different things like that. You can't help but cry. It's so beautiful. You have to cry. In fact, when I got to Burning Man the first day, people said, have you seen the Temple of Forgiveness? It made me cry. I said, yeah, you know, I'll get to it. And then a few days later, somebody said, have you seen the Temple of Forgiveness? It made me cry so much. I said, You know, after a couple more days, somebody says, you got to go to the Temple of Forgiveness. It'll make you cry. I said, I'm going to go there, and I know I'm going to cry. And I went there, and it's poignant. You know, every fear, every doubt, every regret, every pain that you're holding on to is tacked up on that, you know, or written up on the walls of the Temple of Forgiveness. So after this experience, I went to the temple, and I wrote down immediately, my brother, you know, I forgive you. My brother was not the issue. He's a baby, too. And I said, Dad, I forgive you. I wrote it down. Because he was kind of like, you know, without going into detail, he wasn't involved as much. And I sat there, you know, wanting to write down, Mom, I couldn't do it. I said, Mom, I can forgive you. It was sort of halfway. But when I got back to New York, I interfaced with all of them, and we resolved it all for me. I you know, we don't have the time to go into every way it came down, but I can say to you that that experience for me was the only transformative psychedelic experience I've ever had. So then the issue of change comes up. You know, is it, you know, in clinical practice, my experience, you know, earlier was more a transcendent type experience where I sort of bypassed my personality and went down to the ground of my being, melted my issues from the bottom up. You know, that was my psychedelic practice. You know, I've come to think of that as really not just transcendent, but really palliative. Using a spiritual feeling of wholeness and groundedness and integration and love as a soothing palliative over the psychological structure that is not really changed by that experience. So at Burning Man, I had a cathartic experience where I actually re-experienced the psychological issues and re-saw them with adult eyes, with safe, loving adult eyes. And so what it taught me really was that that change really requires both. That there needs to be an ecology of love and acceptance, of positive regard, of safety and trust. All the things that I create in my psychology practice, in my clinical, all the things that I try to attain through, you know, that glowing orb, going to the ground of my being and feeling love and acceptance. But, you know, that process really it needs to be used to ease entry into the depth confrontation, kind of like what MDMA, what ecstasy does, relieves the, you know, the fears and the doubts and enables one to go deeper. So that ecology of love then enables one to feel comfortable, like I was comfortable with my two psychedelic psychotherapists, to go down, to relax the tension of the personality, to enable that natural unfolding to reinitiate. And that's how you get lasting effects. That's really the roots of transformative experience. So can you repair malfunctions in natural development through psychology, through psychedelics? Yeah, I think so. It's kind of like sunlight. It provides light and warmth. so you can see yourself with love. Can it speed up the natural developmental process? I don't think so. I think skewed or stunted development only. Psychedelics are not maturity in a pill. So that Burning Man experience was really an extraordinary, privilege, to be in that environment.
Well, let's, change pace for a second. Let's talk about, how to change the world with psychedelics. Do you believe there is a need to change or reschedule psychedelic drugs, their legality? What steps do you think need to be taken to change drug laws? And how do we change the psychedelic policies and bureaucracies?
Right. Well, you know, like I said before, my research focus from graduate school and research utilization, and my work at Princeton, my dissertation work was under a political scientist actually doing policy research on research utilization in policy making. And so, it's really near and dear to my heart. And, you know, there are a couple of sort of, perspectives or approaches that can be helpful. First of all, as far as the need for psychedelics to be rescheduled, I mean, gee whiz, we've got now 15 years of current research going on. We've got clinical research coming down, just beginning to be published, which is, you know, it's not black and white positive, but it's way positive. So the results are not perfect. There are indeed people who've had stressful experiences, people who haven't had the, you know, expected outcome. So the results are not perfect, but the results are strong and positive that I've seen. And they're just beginning to come out. So when you think about that positive research environment, what are policymakers you've got something now that the research is demonstrating is effective. So it needs to be rescheduled so that research is easier to be done, and that ultimately, with safe, regulated, rules and guidelines for use in clinical practice. Changing current drug laws requires basically doing what we're doing now. Ultimately, we're changing society, and so this is a process, a bootstrapping process, and it's all happening simultaneously. The idea of changing policies and bureaucracies. Oh, you know, by the way, I wanted to point out there's an issue of which drug will be rescheduled first, and basically it kind of boils down to MDMA or psilocybin. And it's interesting that psilocybin has been the one that's
You don't think it'll be cannabis?
Well, yeah, but I don't consider cannabis to be a classic hallucinogen or a psychedelic, although it, you know, obviously is in
some
context.
It can be, and when you eat it in large doses, it certainly can be. Certainly had some amazing experiences with it, but,
cannabis is too hard to work with.
Yeah, it is. I would agree with that.
I mean, clinically, I mean to say.
Sorry,
even
I interrupted
the,
you.
And no, that's okay. I mean, we're interrupting each other. It's good. There's a policy change process. It involves awareness, first interest, evaluation, trial, and ultimately adoption. This is an issue of the quality of the data, the costs and the benefits. The values to different interest groups, the larger economic issues, the political forces. So, the web is a lever for change in this world, too, because we have now, you know, a sort of a accessible international bureaucratic policymaking infrastructure. Hold on for a second. I'm sorry. So, there's a phrase Rick Doblin said once, which really impressed me, was patience is the fastest way. In other words, if you go too slow, then obviously things don't get done. But if you push too hard, resistance is engendered, and then you have to take time to relax that, and then you're back where you were. So patience, going, like Tai Chi style, dancing with your resistance is the best way. So you have to be aligned, really, with the power vector in the policymaking community. You can't really be, at loggerheads. Confrontation or contention is much less effective than partnership. So you need to be oriented and connected in the field. But, of course, like with boundaries and transference in therapy, here again, you have to worry about being co-opted by the system and its rewards. But the levers for change, basically, are the research data have to be valid and reliable. You have to deal with the people, you know, the bureaucratic people in the organization, the owners, you know, the bosses who are concerned with policies and span of control, and the worker bees who are concerned with job security and things like that. And then, of course, you have to consider the strategic context, because even good research handled, you know, organizationally very effectively won't change anything if, you know, if it's, let's say, requires expensive changes and the economy is going down the tubes. So both the data, the people, and the context are important. So yeah, that's a little bit about changing things. But, you know, like I talked about how society, I think, as a whole is changing. What we really want here is a rational policymaking process, something that's fine-grained and flexible, objective, systematic, something that's data-based, the data-based rescheduling of psychedelics. The scheduling system is a mess and needs to be completely revised. There needs to be a logical process for funding approved research. Right now, you know, the psychedelics research gets approved, but there's no funding, federal funding for it. You know, the psychedelic is an opening to a broader definition of healing. Psychedelic medicine, as I mentioned, is being mediated by this peak spiritual experience. Spirituality really is the advanced end of normal adult developmental psychology. You know, what we're seeing is a recognition of the integration of mind-body duality, the healing power, healing as the power of the whole organism, you know, doing its thing. You know, this is an issue really of academic, personal, and religious freedom. There's nothing more American than psychedelics. It's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's also truth, justice, and the American way.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you, you know, more on that.
Let the data fall where they may. Let the data fall where they may. So, you know, there's this enormously positive benefit-cost equation. And, you know, it's important to point out that there's a role of bravery. People like Sasha, you know, who you know, take the drugs themselves, people who get out there and spend 6.5 years trying to get approved for research like Rick Strassman did, you know, people like Rick Doblin. You know, so it's important for all of us, I think, to, you know, to help us move to this reintegration, you know, this completing that movement up the spiral to this sort of integral, neo-pastoralism, where our society is consciously structured in a way, that's similar to the way we evolved, you know, in nature and tribal setups. And that includes the integration of psychedelics into our society, in a beneficial, in a loving, in a safe, you know, just in a way that's considered by all to be appropriate and can help us the way it's helped tribal peoples for millennia.
What do you think is the single most important aspect of your research?
Can I pick a few? Real briefly. The idea of there being a substrate reality and then a precipitate reality, you know, the sort of subtle field underlying everything, which has sort of different rules or different laws of nature, if you will, and then the material world and the mind-body dualism that is associated with that. That concept is crucial to, you know, personal development, to maturity, to wisdom. So for me, that's very, very important. The idea of there being a ground of being, a transpersonal space inside us all that's essentially perfect. That's a psychedelic concept. It's also an Eastern philosophical concept, an Ayurvedic concept of it being about health, about being that, and about being, you know, really essentially perfect inside and recapturing that. That personality is like a twister, like a tornado. That's just air all curled up in a knot. If you could unfurl it, you could see through it. It's still air, it's still oxygen, it's still essential to our existence, but it's not tied up in a knot anymore. So that part is really important. The difference between the personality as the shell and the ground of being as the core true self. And then lastly, the idea of love. of acceptance, of compassion, of feelings essentially of safety, of Darwinian safety. Those issues are crucial, again, in psychedelic practice and also in my clinical practice.
What would you like people to remember from this interview?
Oh, gosh. I guess, the single most important aspects of my research that I just mentioned, I want them to remember my URL, but I want them to remember my sincerity. it's true, but really it's, my practice is about relationship, about trust, about sincerity, really. And, I think that's the same thing in what we all do in trying to move this field forward. We all have had, this experience that's been important to us. And as we grow, we want to share it with others in a healthful way. I'm not in favor, of indiscriminate recreational use by children, or anybody for that matter. I mean, but especially by children. I don't, there's lots of things that we have trouble with in society. Now, granted, tribal societies have rites of passage and we should have them too. But the way it works in our society is just a shame that we haven't re-embraced the tribal wisdom. So I think that's really important as well, to remember that we're in this process of reintegrating, of becoming whole again, of getting through the hurdle of industrialism, of Westernism, of materialism. We're not going to abandon it. We're going to just start doing it right, doing it wisely and lovingly. And it's just a joy to be part of the process, and it's a joy to help, help in some way, to help psychedelics help in that process.
So what was that website address again?
Oh, yes. The website address is just my name, neilgoldsmith.com. It's N-E-A-L. You can get a hold of me there, through, my email address is there. I won't even bother giving it to you. Just neilgoldsmith.com. You can find my email address. I have, I will send you the 10 lessons chapter, if you email me. I have, something on, the safe use of psychedelics in the public, having to do with sitting and dealing with emergencies and dosing and things of that nature. And I've got other documents as well. So I'm happy to help, and send you sort of, there's an interview on YouTube called The Fusion of Spirit and Science, which is really beautiful. And I recommend that to you too. So there's a bunch of things, but if you just contact me through my website, I'll be happy to, answer any questions you like. I love dealing with the public.
Excellent. And,
and I have a book coming out.
I was just going to ask you that.
I shouldn't forget that. Everybody would be mad at me if I forget that. The book is called Psychology. Psychology is the study of the psyche, which is really the soul. It's not, a medical issue. It's not really about the brain, although there's that approach as well. But psychology comes out of, psychology's roots are in the psyche. And I want to really, really return psychological practice to that, issue of ground of being. And so to bring the psyche back into psychology. And
when
that's what
that
book is about. It's called Psychology, Psychotherapy, Psychedelics, and Change. It'll be out next year from Inner Traditions.
Okay. And, I'm going to want an autographed copy of that from you.
I'm going to send you one express mail.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. And we've been listening to Dr. Neil Goldsmith. This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 31. Neil, thank you so much for being a part of the show and this project. I really appreciate your time and dedication to giving us such a wonderful overview of your research, and I hope people find it as much benefit as I have, especially your intersections on psychological issues or really developmental issues, and on treating people safely and humanely, for that matter, when they're coming down on a psychedelic trip or having a bad experience and how to navigate that. And I think that stuff is hugely important. And I've talked about those issues with a number of people, and it's great to hear that you've got a paper. And in fact, if I don't think I have that from you, if you would like to send that to me, I would greatly appreciate it. But thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Well, Jan, I wanted, before we end, just thank you very much for what you do. This is such important work, and, you know, it really needs to be said what great work you're doing. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's fun to do this, but really, you just do it, you know, week by week, and you've got a lot of stuff there from a lot of people. I've benefited from the podcast, so thank you very much. Keep up the great work.
You're welcome, and hope I'll keep it up as long as I can. It's rather exhausting, but the nice thing about it is it keeps me up on my research. So I'll be talking to you again soon.